Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Hello and welcome to Streets Ahead, your podcast for all things active travel, walking, cycling, other things that are active and involve travel. You can tell that I am not reading a script on this particular episode of Streets Ahead because we thought we'd diverge, and we're going to call this episode the Pod Without Portfolio, Laura, aren't we? And you've come up with a brilliant explanation as to how that might work, a metaphor, if you like.
Yeah, we're a pod without portfolio and also without a home today because we're sitting on the banks of the Thames. I was saying that we're like an empty crisp packet drifting on the Thames.
Which I think is brilliant. It's going to be
but
that structured.
But at least
structured.
We're together.
Yeah, we are recording a podcast in face, in person, on the banks of the River Thames. We are between London Bridge and that one there, which
Cannon Street. Cannon Street.
That's the railway bridge that goes into Cannon Street. And I don't know what the bridge is called, actually.
Cannon Street Bridge, maybe.
Maybe. that would make sense. And it's a long time since we've last podded. So I'll start with you, Adam. Weeks. What's been happening in your life?
Went to the south of France. That was nice. So it took some time.
I've never been to Cannes.
Yeah, it's a bit strange. There's designer shops everywhere and everyone just goes up and down in supercars. So you kind of look at them and stuff. Sort of did that. But actually, it was very nice. It was not that bit, but it's got a lovely old town. It's got all, you just go slightly off the beaten track and it's lovely. So did that. Sat on a beach for a bit. That was
very
fun.
Nice. Laura, what have you been up to?
I've been cycling bits of the NCN, the National Cycle Network.
Oh, yes. Now, can you tell us why, do you think?
Yeah. So I'm writing a book.
That's
I've
good
got
news.
A,
very
got a
well
book
done.
Deal.
Yes. Very good.
Which is very exciting. And I'm going to be writing about the National Cycle Network as it is, as it could be, as it should be, what it is, what it means philosophically for the country. Just going to ride it. I'm just going to ride around.
Well, you're not just writing it, you're riding it.
I'm riding it as
riding
well.
Riding it and then writing it.
Riding
presumably
and then
you're not
writing.
Writing and riding. Yeah. That's technical. That's very difficult. But
I could maybe do a voice note while
no,
riding.
You need your hands on the handlebars.
Yeah, hands-free only. Yeah, so I've been cycling around the southeast. I've done from about Canterbury to Brighton, around that corner. It's very nice.
I would like to ask you what on earth the National Cycle Route is. I mean, National Cycle Network is, because I should know, really. If I don't know, what hope is there for mankind? I mean, I ride my bike everywhere, don't have a car, and I work in cycling, and I don't really know what the National Cycle Network is. Because here's the thing. Me and my family, we were getting annoyed about this the other day. We've often talked about Quiet Way 1 in London.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah?
Mm.
Which is one of the better routes.
Yes.
Better designed routes.
And best
I use
of
it,
all the Quiet
I've
Ways,
just
probably.
Literally used it now to come up here. But they've it's no longer called Quiet Way 1. All the bits that say Q1 on the tarmac have been painted over.
So
it's now called CS.
Yeah. No, it's just C.
C?
C, I think, isn't it?
Yeah,
C,
it's no, not, nothing CS anymore. It's no, not allowed to call it Super because it sounds too sporty.
So where's the coherence in all of this? And how does that interlock with the NCN? And what happened to Quiet Ways? Why can't you say cycle superhighways? What does C stand for? And why isn't it all coherent?
Yeah.
If the road network was this incoherent, well, it could never be, could it? Because it just wouldn't function. But it just seems so piecemeal and ridiculous. And it sounds like I'm blaming you.
Yeah, I know. It's going to be my fault now. It's Sustrans' fault at the moment. But yeah, it's a kind of tricky one. Kind of owned by goodness knows how many landowners up and down the country or councils, and then Sustrans tries to manage it best it can. But I think it's a bit like herding cats.
Yeah.
It's like councils of London or Manchester. Some of them want cycle stuff and are happy to give over road space, and then some aren't. But then there's the issue of funding. And so what you end up with is a bit like sort of London, but worse, writ large. There are some great bits. I've been cycling on some really nice bits, like wide, smooth little cycle paths. But then you get the kind of go to a roundabout, and then it just suddenly diverts you onto a pavement with almost no warning. You have to go like three sides of a roundabout.
Yeah, but you're like almost dodgy... answering a question I haven't asked. Because I'm not... So we could talk forever.
What is
we could,
it?
We could, do, we could do an entire series on how bad the actual routes are.
Yeah. That's what Laura's book's going to be.
And occasionally good, to
well,
give them credit.
I think the...
But,
yeah,
but
I think
my starting point is the simple thing of numbering it correctly.
Yeah, you know, okay, numbers,
it,
yeah.
Numbering it so it makes sense.
So I think if you know... NCNs are numbered. So I live in a place where there's an NCN 52, and you can obviously go and look at the maps, and they are...
But they're numbered in a
way
that's
numbered,
like...
But not in a...
The NCN 1 goes from Dover to like Inverness.
Yes.
I know.
But
insane.
Then again, but roads as well. I was reading about the other day that roads are numbered in a particular way, and I can't remember what the way is, but it's the, if it's A1, A2, A3, it's like the postcodes and phone numbers. They are done in a methodical way, but of course people just come to know them as, oh, it's the A406, you know, and that doesn't mean anything to anyone either, unless you look it up.
Is the A406 like a tributary of an A4 or something? Is it? Does it work like that? Because like postcodes.
Yeah, might do.
Yeah,
that makes sense.
But I think
bus numbers are really weird as well, aren't they? That's another subject.
Yeah, but that's the thing. Like, numbers only become recognisable when you know what they are, and the cycleway, the cycle superhighway, that's not the superhighway, and the quiet ways, which are no longer. Quietways.
So what are we left with in London? Do you know?
They're just cycleways. They're C for cycleways.
C for cycleways.
Yeah.
Okay. I'll leave this alone in a second because I'm getting irritated by it. But the NCN network, your N52 and your N1 and your N13, do they run through London as well? Are there also N's in London?
Yeah, London has some NCNs.
The NCN1 goes through London. It goes near me on the Lee River.
I suppose it has to come through London if it's going from Kent to Inverness.
Yeah. But I guess maybe the numbering doesn't matter so much. I'm just thinking about buses. You know, you need to get the 25 or whatever. You know, you need to take the A1 to wherever.
Yeah.
In the Netherlands, they have the knooppunten, the number point system, which confused me at first. When I was cycling around the Netherlands a few years ago. It's like a kind of weird dot to dot, but the numbers aren't necessarily consecutive. So you might need to go like left at 46, and then there might be a 15 that you need to turn right at. And you can kind of write the numbers down. This is what I did, and follow it. But doesn't mean the numbers don't necessarily matter, but just the fact that they're there to help you navigate. So I guess it kind of does make sense. And maybe maybe as the network gets, because it's not a very dense network, the NCN. Maybe as it gets denser, maybe they'll use my idea. They have like NCN1 and they have like little NCN1 something.
1.2s and 1.3s.
Yeah, I quite like that.
I'll tell you what does work well for, but again, it requires a precedent for it to work. And that's in Paris, where, you know, Paris has had a huge uptick in cycling, and some of it, the infrastructure is really good, some of it's not so good. One of the theories that I have about why it's doing so well is that the first pandemic routes that they built during coronavirus and the first lockdown matched the tube lines, the metro lines. So the routes on the street became the metro lines.
That is so smart.
So they're all the same colour on the street, you know, they're all the same signage. So people who obviously take the metro every day, you know, it's so I think obviously that was smart, and that's worked really well.
There was a plan to do that in London many years ago, maybe like 2012 or 13. I think one of the suggestions was to have a sort of circle line, and I remember trying to ride some of these routes, and of course if you're going on the circle line, you go on Euston Road, and who knows what to do with Euston Road, but that was a kind of vague idea, but I don't know why it never happened. Maybe some bits are just too difficult. It's a good idea because it's a network that people know and they can just follow it above ground. But it's interesting, I think people care quite deeply about it. When I used to write a lot for Road CC, whenever we wrote about barriers on cycle routes, people used to pile in that tens and tens of people would pile in on the conversation, and what do we need, like better cycle routes? And it's not just in urban areas but rural areas, and a lot of towns and villages are sort of 10-20 minutes apart by cycle, but there's no real way of doing that.
Yeah. Yep.
The town nearest to the one I grew up in, I only realized couple of years ago that you could cycle there in about 20 minutes, but there's a kind of B road that wasn't A road. It's quite big. You just wouldn't, unless you're quite, you know, quite confident, you wouldn't, just wouldn't cycle on it. So,
or yeah. If you had a road bike, you'd find that some of that route was
just goes muddy or something.
Muddy or kind of, you know, so
yeah,
never
the
take
surface
into
is really rough, grippy.
Yeah. So, yeah. One thing that will be really, like, really interesting, I'm looking forward to reading about when your book comes out, is those sort of more rural communities and kind of like the travel aspect of it as well. Because a lot of people who are in, and myself included sometimes, who are, you know, involved in cycling advocacy and active travel, often think about it from an urban point of view. And actually where I live is on the NCN, and where my wife used to work, you know, was at the other side of the NCN, and she used to ride down the NCN every day. And you know, we're not in a massively built up area, and it's just really, those kind of places are forgotten sometimes, and we have to remember that people do want to cycle and walk in those areas, and they do want to do it safely. They might not be able to afford, or they might not even be able to warrant the cycle superhighway style stuff, but they need something.
Yeah.
And it needs to be good enough for people and everyone to feel like they can use it.
A lot of low incomes in rural areas, a lot of car dependency. When I was growing up in the countryside, I mean, you just had to learn to drive because the buses were so crappy. They're even worse now. So yeah, you basically got to 17, learned to drive, or you were stuck, or you'd take just hours to get everywhere, or we hitchhiked. I was speaking to someone in Wales, the Active Travel Commissioner for Wales, Dafydd Tristan, I should say, who was talking about having a interurban cycleway between Cardiff and Newport.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, which I think is a brilliant idea. I mean, that's two cities that are, well, according to the map, 12.8
miles.
Yeah, like 13 miles apart.
That's doable for lots of people, not for everyone.
Yeah, on an e-bike, that's less than an hour.
Yeah,
so interurban high-speed cycleway. I remember being in Velo City in 2017 in Arnhem Nijmegen, and there's like an they had like a high speed
Arnhem Nijmegen.
Super highway between those two, and we went out to
They're
the Museum of Dutch Life in the and then came back in the evening. It was just wonderful, and it's quite a fair old way, but it's just really, really nice actually. Just on a heavy Dutch bike, just summer evening, it was really, really nice, and all the junctions were really good, and it's totally possible.
2016 Giro d'Italia, stage two and stage three. Stage two was Arnhem to Nijmegen, and stage three was Nijmegen to Arnhem.
I've been to Arnhem, very, very nice.
In that part of the Netherlands, it's called the Gelderland, isn't it?
Yes, Gelderland. Well it's a G.
Try and pronounce it properly, it's Gelderland.
I've got to out-pronounce it, the cycling commentator.
Laura, what's the title of the book?
We don't know yet. I'm not very good at titles.
No, nor am I. I've just published my sixth book, and it's the first time I've ever got a title over the line.
Remind me what it's called.
Cool. Oh, thank you, Laura.
This is so professional.
It's called Square Peg, Round Ball, Football, TV and Me, and it has nothing to do with active travel. But it's a bit of a laugh. Anyway, just to say, good luck with naming the title, because that's my sixth attempt. That's the first title I've actually got over the line.
So your editors would name it for you, or the publishers would name
it
for
you? Yeah, they'd just say, yeah, that's a stupid title. We'll call it this. You know, and you just have to go along with it.
What about How I Won the Yellow Jumper? Was that
there? Yeah, my editor came up with that. I wanted to call it something really pompous.
Oh, really?
And he just said, no, I think you just need a funny joke, and we'll put a cartoonish picture of you on the front cover.
Yeah,
and that was
he was right, I reckon.
Louis Theroux didn't come up with his book title. He's got to get through this. That was someone else.
No, that would be
with
absolutely a focus group in the publishers who'd come up with that. Yeah, but it kind of works, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's good.
Oh, well, good luck with that. Now, you've also got some family news of sorts, haven't you? What's that?
Yeah, so there's a new housing development in my hometown, and some local people got together and suggested that they name one of the streets after my late dad. So it's going to be called Laker Close. Yeah.
Oh, that's so
very
good.
Very sweet, yeah.
What did your... Not everyone gets a street name.
I know.
After them. How's your dad got himself a street name?
So he was a brewer. He had a brewery, which is still going, called Exmoor Ales. Not in the family anymore. Hasn't been for some time. So he did that, and he ran a beer festival, beer and folk music festival, and he was big in the kind of beer campaigning, brewery campaigning industry. He founded SEBA Southwest, the Small Independent Brewers Association, just a big kind of character, big cheerleader for my extremely tiny hometown, always promoting local businesses, and it was just very credible,
local
gregarious.
Dignitary.
An
important figure in the community.
Always looked
like
very
Adam.
Scruffy. Sort of cut off jean shorts and high-tech silver shadows in various states of decay, but he was quite well loved. Yeah, it's very, very sweet. Me and my sister are delighted.
Are you able to influence the design of the street? Can you make sure it's designed to low traffic neighbourhoods?
I'd love to. Yeah. I would love to.
It's going
to
be a dual carriageway, isn't it?
It's off a roundabout.
Oh. pavement parking
on
everywhere.
Road that goes to the, it's quite a busy road. But yeah, it's very sweet anyway. We're dead chuffed.
Excellent.
So
excellent.
It's nice.
What's been happening in kind of politically, Adam, and in the world of policy and stuff? I noticed a story that I didn't really read, I paid cursory attention to, that Grant Shapps was saying stuff about e-scooters, saying, we've got to get to grips with this, probably find some way of regulating it a little bit. Was there much more to it than that? Or
yeah, well, we don't exactly know. The government and all governments tend to give hints about where they're going with legislation, and there's the Queen's speech upcoming where their kind of agenda will be set. And yeah, they're trailing e-scooters as something that both they want to get tough on, I think, but also that they want to try and enable the use of, is what it sounds like. So it sounds like quite a sensible sort of pragmatic way to do it. And the Daily Mail article that I read does seem to take the leap from what he said in a select committee, that they are considering legalising private e-scooters in the upcoming Queen's speech. Grant Shapps did also talk about during that geofencing technology. So it's unclear whether, you know, the private e-scooters now are like lots of mode of transport, including cars, are a free fall. They're not geofenced. You can ride them wherever you like and you have to abide by the law. And as we know, not all road users, regardless of what mode of transport they use, follow the law. But what we're seeing is that they're suggesting potentially that get the legislation, new private e-scooters might need to be controlled in some way. Speed limited, geofence potentially.
I think so. We're the only country, like one of the only countries in the world that haven't legalised them yet. But I wonder if at the same time, if they're talking about geofencing, if we could just geofence cars so they don't go on pavements or...
Well, quite, yeah. And I think that technology...
Yeah, so
you
it's know, actually, joking apart, could be an interesting...
Could be.
Well, this is why I said all the road users thing, because the dissonance is really interesting when you hear, because when you listen, and you've just came halfway through the conversation, you'd be listening to them speak and you kind of be going... What are they talking about? Because they're talking about these, you know, dangerous vehicles that could be, you know, used inappropriately, used in crime. Mm. You know, they some of them can go over the speed limit and things like that. You're going, it's cars, isn't it? And they go, no, it's e-scooters.
It's such new technology and they haven't been around for very long at all and the growth has been so fast. So I suppose it's too early for any evidence base to kind of emerge about whether statistically, mile for mile, vehicle for vehicle, pound for pound or whatever, they are more dangerous than... cars or bicycles or
they're,
any other.
They're more dangerous than bicycles.
They're about
they
motorbikes
are more dangerous
kind of level,
than bicycles.
Aren't they?
Yes.
I think
and is that because
the
there's more pavement hopping and kind of...
It's mainly the theory, and again, the data's at the early parts of it, but bicycles are they're really good, bicycles. They're invented really well. They've got big wheels and often chunky tyres and
yours
things like that. No,
foldy.
I've got tiny wheels.
Yeah, tiny wheels, little clown car, clown bike.
But normally, and joking aside, that's the issue. It's the wheels of scooters. So most of the data, because the US have had more trips and done it earlier, the data seems to suggest that they are, you know, more like inverted commas accident prone. But usually, it's not riders going into pedestrians or riders it's riders being hit by cars. It's riders hurting themselves ultimately. So the theory goes with the small wheels and them not being so stable, a lot of the early ones were designed as almost toys.
Yeah.
And they go down a pothole or they try and go up a curb and people go. So that's why they seem to be more dangerous than bicycles, which are
I would imagine they've got very diverse usership, haven't they? And a lot of that usership is quite young as well, as being all sorts of ages. Like, that's the meaning of diverse, isn't it? So but I imagine they're quite cool things in a way, and there's probably quite a high mucking around quotient on them.
We had a go in a car park, didn't
we?
I was like chasing you.
That's probably contributes to the accident proneness of them, a bit like my commentary colleague David Miller on a Brompton a few years ago, when we were just finished commentating at the Tour de France, he found a BMX park right next to where we were working.
Uh-oh.
And he thought, I'm used to be a professional bikist. I'll take my Brompton onto a BMX track. He came back about 30 seconds later, bleeding profusely from almost every limb.
That reminds me of when we used to go on holiday to a caravan in Bournemouth. It was on a little ridge, probably about sort of knee, mid-drift height. And my dad was on his bike, and he went over the side trying to do a trick. And as he did it, he said, "Who's the daddy?" And crashed and broke his arm.
Your dad's not going to thank you for sharing that.
But it was quite good fun. But the wheels is one of the issues. And also there was another theory. And again, these are just theories at this stage. But because they are illegal, private e-scooters, they are generally ridden in a way that feels illegal. That's not even necessarily the people using them. It's not saying a certain demographic of thieves are using them. It's just saying that when something is not allowed, people kind of behave in a slightly different way. You know, they might run traffic lights, because if you stood at traffic lights, you're more likely to get pulled over because you're not moving, for example.
You get naughty kids on bikes as well, don't you? I mean, sort of.
And in cars
and
as well.
In cars, yeah.
Yeah, naughty people are everywhere. They're in government.
Yeah.
At the very highest level in this country as well. But without wishing to get involved in that, that's interesting. But what I'd like to know is how many people on e-scooters know that they're not legal? What's the percentage of people who are actually aware that they're not legal?
It's really hard, isn't it? Because if you're ever told off for doing something, your first instance is go, "Oh, I didn't know I can do that.
Again,
sorry."
Again, we come back to the highest level of government. To the best of my knowledge.
But even being, you know, a naughty kid, and they said, "Oh, you know you shouldn't do that. Oh, I didn't know. Sorry." Or whatever. And when it comes to e-scooters, the theme that I hear time and time again is, "Oh, people don't know they're illegal." But I'm pretty sure it's people going, "Oh, I didn't know it was illegal. I'm sorry, officer." Yeah. So it's very hard to know. But it is easier to know that there's about 750,000 to a million private e-scooters in this country. So, you know, they're out the bag. They're not going anywhere.
No, that's very true.
And I think that's why the government's probably considering how it can enable them, because it's too far gone to rein them in. And they're sensible, they're fun. When I was in Cannes, I was in a cafe with my wife and sat outside, and, you know, there's this pedestrianised sort of street while a filter with a bollard with two, you know, each end, and people on bikes, but it's just people on scooters, just normal people just going about their daily business using small, light-powered vehicles, and it was fine. They weren't stressed about it so much. There was pedestrians walking, and I saw a person on an e-scooter go very close to a pedestrian overtaking. The pedestrian was on their phone, so it's the kind of thing that could shake you up if you weren't expecting it. But there's something there, because the people were just sort of so used to it. It would just become part of the landscape. There was no flinching going on. It was just sort of, we're all here. We're all coexisting. So who knows if the time will change that, because when the first film came out, and if you see where I'm going with this, you don't know where I'm going with this. The first film, cinema, first ever cinema was a film of a train coming down the road. And everyone ran out the cinema.
Yeah.
Maybe it's just like that.
Yeah. I kind of understand. The genie's definitely out of the bottle, but I'm intrigued by this idea of what did you call it?
Geofencing.
Geofencing. So I understand the principles behind it, but I'm not sure I want to see that, really. I don't know. That feels a bit controlling, doesn't it? Because say you manage to apply it to scooter riders, then cyclists? Mm. Do they get pedestrians? Do our smartphones start to vibrate and warn us that we've gone into... We've strayed
have little
into
collars, couldn't we?
Yeah, a little electric shock delivered. You know, you're in a territory you shouldn't be in.
Elon Musk is listening to us going, "Oh, this is a good idea. We can get Musk ideas.
But it's that kind of like... I mean, actually, quite a good example of that strange netherworld of public-private space and are you allowed to do this or aren't you allowed to do this? I think quite a good example of right where we're sat now. We're on the north bank of the Thames Walk. We're on the Thames, as I say, in between London Bridge and Cannon Street Railway Bridge. And you're never quite sure who the land belongs to here, whether or not you're allowed to, I don't know, record a podcast here or you're going to get moved on. Can you cycle here? I'm not sure that's really, you know, and all that sort of thing. And occasionally, the path isn't continuous because someone has just bought the right to develop their property right up to the river, and they keep the public out.
Yeah.
And I don't know if I'm stretching a point.
I think it's right.
Do you see what I'm getting at?
Yeah, maybe if you were filming on one of the private bits, on your phone, it would just stop.
The irony up by where the City Hall is, you just about see it from here. That's all, more London is all private land.
Yes.
You know, you can... You know, it's probably a metaphor, really, isn't it? Because you've got they're moving now or have moved, but you've got the Mayor of London in a building which was sort of, I think, funded privately in land that's privately owned.
Yeah.
that where the owners can control whether you're allowed to cycle there or allowed to take photos, whether
you're
allowed to
interview
the mayor there potentially outside the front.
I remember we had to interview back in Boris Johnson's era. I had to interview him inside.
Yeah,
because we didn't have a permit outside. To film outside.
Oh, exactly. So it's quite strange. And I saw something on Twitter the other day about the Thames cycle path further up from where we are now, but up towards Greenwich, and when you get to the O2 around there, you know, a lot of that is a mishmash of private and public land, and someone's taken it upon themselves to put a load of no cycling signs, and not sure whether they're doing that on behalf of a developer, whether they're on behalf of, you know, just because they don't want cycling there and they're just one person with a printer.
Yeah.
That's quite difficult. And actually here, if there was e-scooters here, well, I didn't know, you know, there's a guy cycling, I cycled up here, don't know whether I'm allowed to cycle here, you know.
Yeah, I was doing ginger cycling.
Yeah, exactly.
You know.
It's totally up to the private landowner whether I can cycle here, and it's in some terms and conditions. And you have to rely on the security guy over there, who hasn't stopped us being here, saying, oh, it's against the rules. Well, you know, that's a bit of a faith. But yeah, the good way to often spot if it's private land is how nice the paving is.
Yeah.
If the paving's nice, it's normally privately owned.
Generally speaking, it's private, yeah. Mm.
Did you know it's almost exactly 2 years since we recorded our podcast?
No.
Yeah. Wow. We launched the first one on the 24th of April, because I thought it must be around this time of year.
What's today's date?
28th.
28th.
Oh, okay. Just over 2 years then.
Two-year anniversary, friends. Yeah.
Happy birthday to us.
Sort of mad, isn't it, really?
Yeah.
It's nice that everything seems so strange in the, still quite strange now, but the, you know, the first lockdown, it was really, you know, it was great. I just rang you up, didn't I, Laura, and said, oh, do you want to do a podcast? And then rang Ned, and to my amazement, as a professional broadcaster, he said yes.
So I'm still here.
And now he's stuck with us.
Yeah.
Not at all. It's a great opportunity to plug my books.
That Venn diagram crossover between the people who used to love
one
football
of you. Come
and
on,
the ones who love active
got to
travel.
Be one of you.
Now I'm going to read your book. Sounds good.
That actually provides a reasonable kind of question, doesn't it? How much has improved? How far have we come in 2 years? Probably that is a question I should have given you a little bit of time to think about before springing it on you. It'd be quite interesting to go back and listen to those first couple of episodes. We were full of excitement about the potential revolution that was on our...
Yeah.
But I think we were also wise enough to understand that, well, I'd like to think we were, that this isn't a given and it's not necessarily going to be easy.
No.
Well,
but have we made the progress we thought we'd make?
I just cycled along Cycle Superhighway, Cycleway 2 now, I think it's called. And there was always a big gap between that one that goes from Stratford to Aldgate and then the one that kind of goes all the way east to west past Parliament Square. And they've just opened it in the last couple of days, this sort of link between the two sort of major cycleways. And it's always been a bit of a hodgepodge before which way you go. I mean, in London, so much has changed. But I think outside of London, it's a very, very patchy picture. I think, like, within London, it's... I don't know.
Is it true?
Yes.
Yeah.
Is it?
Okay. Yeah, I think so. Like, I can, you know, and I'm acutely aware of this in the West Midlands, that we're starting, you know, 10 or 15 years behind. That's a real hindrance, and it takes a lot of time to build a cohesive network. Did you not check the flight paths before you booked this location?
I think it changes depending on the wind, doesn't it? Yeah.
Adam's just paused there. Because a loud aeroplane was going overhead, approaching City Airport from the west.
Oh, is that what it was? I was just wondering.
I used to be obsessed with civil aviation when
really?
I was a kid. Yeah, it was a big passion of mine. Hold that thought, Adam. I will come back to it,
the point
you were making. But when the wind is blowing from the east, which it has been, that's why it's been a bit chilly in London the last few days, they do approach City Airport from the west. So they fly in right over the Thames and turn
with
the
tailwind.
Yeah. Did I ever tell you my story about the bike racks at City Airport? I'm sure I
did. No. I heard this.
Well, you've got a... I'm sure I must have told this on the podcast. Well, if I did, apologies, you're about to hear it again. And if I haven't,
how could
I have held this one back? You know, you're saying you've got a street named after your dad in...
Somerset.
West Somerset. I claim, it's not actually true, but I'm going to just claim it anyway, that the bike racks outside City Airport...
are called Ned.
They should be called Ned's Bike Racks, and they should have a plaque next to it. Because I think I... basically am the reason why they exist. One day, about 10 years ago, I was, and this is obviously shameful because I would never do it now, but I had to go up to Glasgow or Edinburgh and back down in a day.
Yeah.
And I flew. I'm sorry, I shouldn't have flown. I wouldn't make that choice now. It's for work. All I had to take with me is a little rucksack. And I live quite close to City Airport. I rode my bike there, There's nowhere to chain my bike up.
Amazing.
So I chained it up to a lamppost right outside the sliding doors at the front of the city airport.
Make
so
a point.
I went off, went to Glasgow, came back in the evening.
The bike was gone.
And the bike was gone.
Yeah.
And I thought,
somewhat of a security alert.
No one's nicked it because, you know, it's the last place you're going to nick a bike. So I went to the security people and they went, is that your bike then, was it? And I went, yeah. And he said, well, we've impounded it. And I said, why? And they go, security risk. What do you mean a security risk? What, it's not an exploding bike? Or what are you talking about? It's a security risk. So what's the nature of the risk involved? He goes, well, it's just the security risk, right? So I said, well, what have you done? Have you blown it up? You've taken away and had it shot? And he goes, no, so we've impounded it in our warehouse. It's about 2 miles down the road in this part of East London. And I went, well, how am I going to get there? And I go, well, not my problem, mate. So I went all the way, I had a walk in the end. I walked all the way down to this warehouse. And I said, I think you've got my bike. And by now I was in a foul mood. And I picked my bike up and I said, where's the lock? And he goes, we broke that. And I went, right, okay. Anyway, I jumped on my bike, cycled home, sat at my desk when I got home, wrote a furious letter.
I bet.
Saying this, that and the other. And then saying, I attached an invoice for replacement of the property you damaged. Which
did
if you don't pay, I'll sue you for damaging my property, like that. And then I billed them for another £100 for the sheer amount of distress it had caused me. And if you question that, I'll sue you as well.
Oh, my gosh.
I was so angry. Anyway, they paid up.
Wow.
And the next time I went there, about a year later, there were bike racks outside.
There we go.
What were you saying anyway?
I don't know now.
There's another aeroplane comes into land at City Airport.
Continuity.
You were saying outside of London.
Oh, yeah, I'm acutely aware outside of London and you know, where I'm in the West Midlands, you know, building a network is hard, and we are starting with somewhat of a delay. You know, London started a lot earlier, but I feel like you can come to London now and you can largely get to where you need to by bike and you know...
Between what's the point people are?
Yeah, some people are.
Which are the numbers we want, but visibly, tangibly,
yeah,
people are.
We're still in other places that, you know, sometimes there's not even a pavement sometimes, and people aren't thinking about the routes and the connections. And even when this is something that's coming up in my work a lot, is even when we're getting it right, i.e., you know, we want to build stuff, we need to make sure we build the connections to the stuff, right? Because if we spend all of our, and that's what London's done quite badly and then quite well, because I think Quiet Ways has quite a lot of criticism about, you know, other than number one, you know, that they were kind of backstreet routes with no level of traffic filtering or anything.
They were at the mercy of the boroughs, weren't they?
Yeah, exactly. So I think what often happens, we're starting to build these really good, high quality arterial routes, and this is not just the West Midlands, I think, you know, other places doing them, but even if we do that for the next 10 years continuously, we're going to have to connect people to those routes, because even if each city has 5 or 8 of these big arterial routes, that still probably leaves, you know, 80% of the city's residents not being able to access them because they haven't got the safe routes to get to the places they need to do. So that's where I think London's done quite well. I think it went through a bit of a problem with the Quiet Ways. They obviously weren't perfect, but now, you know, there seems to be quite coherent routes that aren't just the big arterial routes. It seems to be getting better with the low traffic neighborhoods, but also, you know, that will generally become a bigger and bigger network, and still a long way to go. I think it's quite interesting, isn't it? You were just saying about in the Netherlands they're building these big cycle, you know, literal cycle super highways, like
exactly.
Motorways for bikes. That's sort of what you do when you've done the cities. You kind of like start to tie up.
E-bikes have changed quite a lot as well. They've made sort of longer distance routes a lot more possible and for a lot more people. But yeah, maybe it is. Because I mean, the thing about sort of rural versus urban is that the urban, obviously the low-hanging fruit is in urban areas where there's a lot of short trips. But actually, even in the countryside, like where I grew up, the sort of villages and towns are surrounded by hamlets and smaller settlements. And I was listening to Brian Deegan doing a presentation about his hometown, Harpenden, and talking about how with 5 modal filters they could make the entire town a low traffic neighborhood, and then, you know, there's 20 minutes to St Albans on a main road, and if you built a cycle lane there, and it's like, it's not always huge stuff actually, and if you think about
it doesn't need to be expensive,
and actually you made me realize just how little, because you think five modal filters. But yeah, I mean, that's what he reckons.
That's the sort of the with the cost side, often it's quite daunting to say, well, we're not going to be able to do this area because we just can't afford to or whatever. But actually, if you've got the political will and the courage to do it, you know, I heard Brian also make a point that, you know, bollards are on their own affordable, but if you have to put them every 4 meters or every 2 meters, because if you don't put a bollard there, someone will park there or whatever, you end up with a whole city or a whole town needing thousands of bollards, whereas you could just put four on the way in and then you don't need any bollards. And that's obviously an extreme, but it does show that if you've got the courage, you can cut down on the spend.
I think I underestimated quite how, just hearing you talk there, Laura, about what they're doing in the Netherlands and also some examples from back here, how, and this is one thing that might really have changed significantly in the 2 years that we've been doing this podcast, the impact that electric bikes are having now and will continue to have, and the speed at which they're changing our perception of what is possible and the accessing a different section of society. I don't think, rewinding to 2 years ago, I don't think that was necessarily a given, was it? I don't think any of us had understood quite how much of a paradigm shift they might bring about, actually.
Yeah, I think there was a sort of inkling, and I remember Deloitte did a report, I think it was before the pandemic, talking about how there were sort of five major tech developments that were going to change the world, and e-bikes was one of them. But I think that was kind of one of the early sort of signs that you got from the mainstream that this was going to happen, but the pandemic really accelerated that. But yeah, we're just way behind places like Germany. We sell like a couple of 100,000 e-bikes a year, and they're on something like 1 million. But yeah, it does seem to have accelerated it, and it's really nice, especially going out of London and cycling around. You do see more people with e-bikes. Saw some people on the weekend with mountain bikes out in the sort of South Downs area. It's really nice for leisure, but also
it's going to eventually, that will chip away at that very valid argument that you butt up against in this country.
Hills,
the
terror.
Yeah, hills, and also, when you talk about car ownership, for example, you say, well, it's all right for you, you're in London, I need my car, I live in the country. Yeah. Well, I get that. The more that these networks potentially rolled out and the more the e-bikes are sold, the less validity that argument has.
Yeah.
I can't remember the exact stat, but I remember one of the first press briefings that Grant Shapps did, and it was a great bit of data they've been obviously given by a civil servant who wanted to make the point, and that was that outside London, you know, the average car journey is still only something like 2.8 miles or something like that. So, you know, people, wherever you go, London's the extreme because, you know, lots of people don't own cars. But the people that do own cars, you know, are still using them for short journeys. And that's the same as it is outside of London. You know, we're using our cars to pop to the shops. And while we don't have the walkable neighbourhoods, they're still not long car journeys. You know, they're not long by any stretch of the imagination. So you'll always get that, but I think e-bikes really normalize it and make it feel like, just take the, people drive cars because they're easy, they're there, they don't require any thought. I sometimes wouldn't ride my manual bike, if you like, my analog bicycle, if I can't be bothered, or I don't want to get changed, or I don't want to be sweaty or whatever like that. But when I'm going on, you know, just half a mile or a mile, I'll just jump on the e-bike because I just know it's super, super easy. And yeah, that's been a big difference to me. And I think it's a great product, isn't it? If we just assume that all humans are inherently lazy, myself included, making it as easy as possible seems like a smart move.
I'm beginning to really enjoy sharing the road with e-bikeists as well, because I've just realised it's just like having a derny.
A derny, exactly.
So I just jump on the back. I must annoy the hell out of them. I've got no shame. I just jump on the back. Laura, you've come here on an e-bike.
Yeah, it's a really upright one. I've had someone sort of sitting on my back. I was quite pleased, actually.
Well, it gives you a minor aerodynamic advantage as well, being on the front. Yeah, having someone on your back wheel is actually a slight advantage for you as well. So there you go. That's
quite nice to help a fellow cyclist. I don't mind it.
What I have noticed in just a couple of years, because I've been to Paris quite a few times, and I do mention it, and I mention Paris quite a lot because I think it's a city that's...
Can I just ask for you, has Anne Hidalgo, is she no longer
she's
the mayor?
No, she is, yeah.
Did they have mayoral elections at the same time as the
president? No, So she did that thing where, you know, you say, I'm going to be president, but I'm not going to give up the job I'm doing. Oh, okay, so you've got something to go back to.
Right, okay. She was a presidential candidate in the first round.
Yeah, she was. Fine, Gotcha. But Paris is really interesting because some of it's not brilliant. It's definitely not pretty. But they've made a massive difference, and they've shown that you can do it very, very quickly. And some of that's the infrastructure. And then just talking about e-bikes and how quickly that can build you a cycling culture. I don't think we have the e-biking kind of casual culture in this country. Like the bike that Laura has, this sort of sit-up bike with its knee bike that's clearly for utility, don't see that many of those. You know, often you see more e-cargo bikes potentially, But in Paris, what they did is they gave everybody the opportunity to, I mentioned this before, but to borrow an e-bike for up to 6 months by paying...
6 months?
Yeah. They have to pay like a monthly subscription fee, about €40 it was. And that included maintenance and a lock and things like that. You got to use it for 6 months, €40 a month. So when the public transport messages, we had the same messages as us, you know, don't use public transport or whatever. One of my family members lives in Paris and, you know, she got an e-bike and, you know, I just never had her down as someone who would ever ride a bicycle for transport. And she did. And then at the end of the 6 months, not only do you get a super cheap loan of a bike, you get €500 credit, basically a subsidy from the government to buy your own e-bike. So what you see in France is this really kind of casual e-cycling culture with lots of mums on like long tail cargo bikes with kids on the back and just lots of people just riding cargo e-bikes. And we don't have that here yet.
My suspicion is that the language and the discussion around cycling is a little bit less toxic and has been as a
I don't know. In Paris, the motorist union took Anne Hidalgo to court when she closed the road along the Seine. I think in France, yes, generally, but in Paris, it still very much has some of the same issues that I think other cities would have.
I think there's a lot of people who live outside of Paris, isn't it? Often driving in, but I don't know.
Yeah.
And they're the ones that want to keep it open.
Yeah. What else have we yet to touch on?
Do you remember that bit that you did from Paris when you were there? You were riding around. We never used that, did we? No, we didn't use it.
Did I send it to you?
Yeah, you did. Oh, well, we just haven't found a place to put it. So now we're talking about Paris.
Yeah, maybe it's a pod with that portfolio.
Maybe we could pop that in. Because it seemed a shame not to use it. Yeah.
All right, this is me in Paris. I can't even remember what I said. All right, I'm in Paris. And it's about 7 o'clock in the evening. Just had dinner. Just had a work meeting, vaguely. Kind of ended up in Paris by accident, but that's another story. Anyway, it's nice to be here. I haven't been here since the Tour de France finished here in 2019, and then COVID changed everything, didn't it? But I'm back again, and quite a lot's changed. I mean, the mayor in Paris has really put in some measures here to promote cycling specifically. And I'm on a Vélib now, one of the hire bikes, just about to cross the River Seine with Notre Dame to my right, which is still being reconstructed. And because I've had a few meetings and bits and pieces to do, I've been all over Paris today, this afternoon, and I've noticed how many segregated cycle lanes there are. Almost every street, and there are many one-way streets in Paris for cars, have now been authorised sort of as two-way exclusively for cycles. Whoops, just got over some cobbles. Which is just great, you know. So basically there's not a street, it seemingly in central Paris, there's not a street you can't go down as a cyclist. And there are loads of streets you can't go down if you're driving a car. So so it's really good. And the Rue de Rivoli is obviously the kind of crowning centrepiece of that, the big street with all the shops on it. And that's basically two-thirds of it have been given over now exclusively to bikes. And there are lots and lots and lots and lots of people on bikes. Tourism hasn't really come back to Paris yet because of COVID. And so these people are Parisians. And I think they're really showing the way forward. So I've just gone through the Marais, and I'm heading for the Gare du Nord actually to catch my Eurostar home. And it's a lovely evening here in Paris. Honestly, it's a remarkable shift that's happened, and it does show the way forward, because Paris honestly was not always like this. I've been coming here for 20 years on an annual basis, and cars have dominated this city just like many others in the world. And it just shows with a bit of political will what can be done. And with the buy-in from the population, I think they might be reaching that kind of point of, what's the phrase, critical mass, kind of holy grail of cycling activists. Feels like that anyway, certainly tonight. I mean, all right, it's a nice evening. But it's a perfectly ordinary evening, it's just a Monday evening, people going about their business. And so also today, the Paris-wide, the 30 km an hour speed limit was introduced. I must admit,
I don't see too much evidence of that being strictly adhered to, because what cars there are here, and believe me, there are still plenty, don't worry, a lot of the drivers are exceeding that speed limit still. So incrementally, bit by bit, but the pace of change here in Paris is pretty fast, I have to say. And just to reinforce this point, because I'm really looking out for it now, I mean, every street in central Paris is accessible in both directions for cyclists. Really is remarkable. Just stopping at a red light here. I also noticed that actually on the train heading into the Gare du Nord from the airport this morning when I flew in, I noticed that in the suburbs as well, outside the centre, there are special streets called, I think they're called Route de Vélo, and there are signs on these streets repeated at kind of 50-metre, 100-metre intervals that say, this is a street in which if you are driving a car, it is not allowed to overtake a cyclist. You must wait. Which is it's a thing I've not seen before anywhere in the world. That's pretty amazing too. Big fan of this, as you might have guessed. But then again, I like France, don't I? Well, I'm now very close to the Gare du Nord, and I'm on a segregated cycle lane with a curb alongside me, just being overtaken. And on the road itself, there are two lanes of traffic, series of red lights that are constantly stopping the motorised traffic. But every time we go over a crossing, a side street, we have to give way for pedestrians at zebra crossings, clearly. But there's priority for this cycle lane. In other words, the bikes fly through and the cars don't. I mean, they really don't. And it's not congested. There's not a big traffic jam of cars. But it really would, you know, if you were sitting in a car looking at the way that the cyclists are making progress here, you'd think twice about your choices because they're being prioritised.
I like Paris. I'm a big fan of Paris. And I've just come back from, talking about your travels, I've come back from a little writing research trip to Belgium and France. And it's quite interesting noticing the different cycling cultures in the two different countries, because they are neighbours. And in some ways, they are both respectively the heartland of road racing, which is obviously what interests me, especially Belgium. It's just crazy for it. I was actually, the first port of call when I went over the channel was to Lille. And I was very impressed with their cycle hire scheme there. It was really easy to use because they can be a bit off-puttingly complex, can't they, when you first get there and you kind of like, it's always down.
Brussels got one and it's awful. The one in Brussels is pre-Velib in Paris. Oh, so right. The technology is, you know, really 15 years, yeah. Like 10,
maybe
15 years old
newer.
Now. So.
Is your Lille one newer?
Yeah, it must be.
Yeah, it's very new and very straightforward. New. And I contrasted that with, I had quite a quick, when I was travelling from Belgium down to southwest France, I had to just pass through Paris. I had to get from the Gare du Nord to Montparnasse. Damn it, I wish I'd had my Brompton with me, my folding bike, because that would have been the ultimate way of getting there. But I had a big old heavy suitcase as well, so I had to get the metro, which is fine. I like the metro. But I hadn't taken the metro for a while, and I was stunned to realise that you still have to queue, unless you have their Oyster card, I can't remember what it's called. You have to queue.
Oh, for tickets.
To get a paper ticket. Just
like, and they get you the carnets.
Carnet of 10, or the individual journey of 1. And it's still those little card, you know, chewing gum sized tickets.
And they're too small to fit anywhere in a wallet, so you just lose them.
And I was getting really stressed because the queue I was in to use the machine to buy that ticket was took me 15 minutes to get to the front. And I thought, that's strange for a joined up city like Paris not to have a better system of using their public transport. But
London's
annoying. Brilliant though. I think we're spoiled here. I think yes. I remember being in New York and the signage, like how you get or where you need to be, is just awful, and it kind of makes you realize that actually in London it's just easy.
Yeah, and using transport for London, obviously with the just swiping in and swiping out with your contactless card is two things though. It's one, it's brilliant. Two, it's quite sneaky, isn't it? Because I think I've mentioned this before, you never have any idea how much you're spending because it doesn't say.
Yeah, it's true.
It doesn't tell you. It just says, go on. And doesn't say, we've just debited £5.80 to come from zone 3 into zone 1 or whatever it is, because I'm just guessing because I don't know how much it is.
Yeah.
But I always find that a really quite compelling when you're talking to Londoners about, well, I wouldn't cycle in London. I'd say, check how much you're spending on your thing. And they go, oh, yeah, I never thought about that.
Mm.
All right, so that's just about it from episode whatever it is.
Yeah.
Is on. I'm going to ask as a special treat for our listeners, I'm going to ask Laura to read the script that closes the show.
You've been listening to Streets Ahead. Our editor has been Claire Mansell. Let us know what you think at Pod Streets Ahead. Rate and review us and share the podcast with anyone you think might enjoy it. Goodbye.
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 Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello? Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.